So again, to jump right in, we called the title of this, I think, the intersection of faith and doubt. So I did this when I did the class, and I'll do it again this time. I want to lay a little bit of just groundwork. First, what does the word doubt even mean, at least in this context? And, you know, so first some fundamentals. Jenny and I believe in God. We believe in Jesus. We believe in the salvation that comes. So to me, the questions and discussion about doubt, while sometimes they really are about is God there and is God present, most of the time, I think my favorite way of thinking about what is this topic of doubt is really almost anything short of certainty. So in some sense, there is, and what this to me discussion is about, when you are questioning things or trying to figure things out in your head, or when anyone is trying to figure things out in their head, there's something short of certain. And it's kind of finding comfort in that place that is kind of, I call it between certainty. And what I mean by that is you could have absolute certainty in, name anything, the existence of God, a position on, you know, whether something is a sin or not, or whatever that might be. And to the opposite extreme, as you know, there are folks who have the almost exact level of certainty at the opposite end. There is no God. That's clearly not a sin, whatever the case might be. Most of us, I think, in various degrees, on various topics, live in between those two things, in the kind of spectrum of questions. And again, we'll use the word doubt in this discussion. But it's that type of conversation that prompted me to want to do this class. For those of you who recall last time, lots of factors to me led, at least for my desire to teach the class the first time, and that was just growing older, and Jenny's going to talk a little bit about that in a second. Just I used the quote last time. I think it's a Bob Dylan quote. I'm not sure, but the line that says, I was so much older than I'm younger than that now. And I kind of feel that way. The things I thought I knew for sure, I'm maybe not so certain anymore. And then I think what almost all of you can relate to is I had a teenager. And in particular, our oldest, although all of them have had various forms of questioning, our oldest was quite a, is still quite a questioner. And it caused us to rethink how we answered questions, how we approach things. I would refer you, because I think he does a better job than I do, to the handout that we handed out, the very first quote. And just, I guess, to clarify, going through this last time, I came across and read a whole lot of interesting things. And so all we tried to do on the front and back of this page is collect what to me were some of the quotes and whatever captures that resonated with me, and I hope with you as well, about this whole subject. But I would read the first paragraph at Philip Yancey, great book called Reaching for the Invisible God. Doubt is the skeleton in the closet of faith. I know no better way to treat a skeleton than to bring it into the open and expose it for what it is. Not something to hide or fear, but a hard structure on which living tissue may grow. If I ask every person to stop reading whose faith has wavered as a result of tragedy or confidence-shaking encounter with science or another religion or disillusionment or individual Christians, I might as well end the book with this sentence. Why then does the church treat doubt as an enemy? And I love this line. I was once asked to sign Christianity Today magazine statement of faith without doubt or equivocation. I had to tell them I can barely sign my own name without doubt or equivocation. And so that was what got me interested in teaching the classes. Frankly, I've been to church my whole life, and I don't know I've ever been to a class that kind of up front talked about dealing with doubt and how you do it and kind of the thought process that you go through. So that got me interested in, you know, what would that look like and how would it work. So today we're going to kind of break it into three kind of mini discussions. First of all is just how you deal with doubt, and in particular how doubt affects your maturing process. And then secondly, just given my reference to my child, a little bit of a discussion about doubt as you talk to kids. And then we'll end, I hope, with a discussion, if we do good on time, a discussion about how the church can deal with doubt, as we have all of us part of the church. So I'm really going to just hand it over. Jenny read a book and I think was influenced a lot by thinking on some of this, so I'm going to ask her to tell a little bit about her experience. You want to close this door?
Kind of a sweet baby crying. Well, first let me tell you what was going on in my life when I read this book. Sam, I had in the last 8 years, my father's died. I've watched my mother go through grieving and building a new life. Some of my siblings have had divorces. I've had friends that have died. And as John referred to, I have had teenagers. My kids have been leaving. And all those things are just what happened. You know, there's nothing fixable about that. And for me particularly, watching my kids leave was just heartbreaking. I just loved having them in my orbit. I loved being part of their day in and day out life. But as anyone knows, when they've got kids that have left, there is a time where you think, yeah, it's time. Like, they're ready. So I was dealing with those kind of issues, which none of those are unusual. Everybody in the room has gone through those kind of things, and you have to just kind of get comfortable making peace. And I was kind of struggling. And I read this book. So this book cleared up what made sense of what I was feeling. Let me also say first two things that I told my kids that really bit me during their teenage years. One, I always told them that they had to develop their own relationship with God, and that that was between them and God. And if their faith ended up looking different than mine, then that was my problem. I had to let them go where God led them. And I couldn't make their world shrink to the size that I could envision. And that sounded very easy when my kids were little. Secondly, I always told them, if God is big enough to create the world, he can handle any question that you may have. And that he need to always be willing to ask them. And I would love to be able to hear them, just because I'm interested in you and I love you, but may not have the answer, but don't be afraid to question God. He created the world. He can handle it. And again, that was easier said than done when they became teenagers. So in the midst of kind of sorting through how to deal with kids that were asking questions I didn't know the answers to, going through hard things with people that you just can't do much more than just be with them, I read this book, and it's called Falling Upward by Father Richard Rohr. He's a Catholic priest. And he talks about the second half of life spirituality. In the first, he divides life into two sections. The first half is your container years. And those are like your growing up years through your 30s and 40s, where you're building your life. You're figuring out who you are, what your family's going to look like, kind of building your core of who you are. And during those years, you need a lot of guardrails, and a lot of things need to make sense. And things are probably a lot more black and white in those years, and they need to be. If you don't do your first half of life right, you'll have a hard time feeling at peace into the second life. And according to him, people that are raised in traditional conservative first halves tend to phase into the second half healthier. And so that was comforting to me. But then there's a point where you stop needing the container, and you start focusing on the life that you've built, and what does it really mean? And the rules aren't as satisfying anymore because they're not needed. And that's where you're phasing into the second half of life. And that's where I was at. All those things I'd always kind of said didn't really feel very satisfying, I guess is the best word I can come up with. So the book gave me great peace and helped me kind of make sense of what I was feeling. I felt kind of like a cliche, actually, when I read the book, because I felt just like what he described. But it was nice to know that that's normal. So if you're in your container years, you know, enjoy them. I mean, I like the second half. There's nothing negative, but don't feel like you need to be in your second half when you're still building your container, because that's an essential part of your life. If you have young kids, you need things to be clear and make sense and secure. But on the next phase, it's been very comforting to think it's okay just to relax and say, I don't know. You know, God's going to have to figure this one out. And when I watch my kids go through some things, I'm thinking, you know, I wonder how God's going to use that and how I'm not going to be the person with the answer. And so I think we're going to go now. John has a video of this man summarizing his book. And he put just a clip of the video, a small portion of the video. So if you're interested, this, like everything else, is on YouTube. Father Richard Rohr has a lot of videos.
So he apparently gave a lecture at Texas Lutheran, where he kind of went through his whole book. All we're going to cover is a very short section. But the what he is about to talk about is what he defines as being elder, not like elder in the church, but this second half phase and some of the characteristics of what that might look like. And I thought that might be helpful for discussion.
Shadow boxing or shadow land.
Is that loud enough?
New problems, new directions, and finally falling off. The title that might strike you as the most strange is The Bright Sadness. I deliberately chose those two words that don't maybe easily go together to try to express what appears to me to be the paradox of a true elder. And we are creating a lot of elderly people, but not a lot of elders. An elder is someone who, it seems to me, does carry a kind of gravitas, sadness, seriousness. They've seen too much. They've been hurt a number of times. They've experienced a number of deaths. You can't just giggle at everything anymore. You know this business of life is serious and short. And by my age, you want to start making sure you're getting the message, because you know it's going to be over in a few years. And you long for what the message is, what this life is all about. But simultaneous, and I hope you've met such an elder, simultaneous to that gravitas, that underlying seriousness, there's a brightness, there's a freedom, there's a joy, there's an okayness, there's a contentment, there's an ability to say to the youngers, to the juniors, it's okay, it'll be okay, it will work out. In fact, if you can't say that to the youngers, I don't know what good you are as an elder. I don't know what you're doing for your grandchildren. That's your role, right? To be giving the security, the solidity, the okayness. I can hold this together. What you see in an elder is an ability to deal with creative tensions. I look at our politics in America. I mean, it makes you wonder. I mean, just that these are our well-educated people that we elect and send to Washington, and all they can do is what I call dualistic thinking, either-or thinking. That's precisely not wisdom. Wisdom has always been defined as the ability to see things in terms of both and. That's the difference between knowledge and wisdom. In the first half of life, you get a lot of information that sort of inflates you. While you're right, your political party has the whole truth, and your country has the whole truth, and your religion has the whole truth. Unless you go through the necessary suffering, you don't see that this is not love of truth, it's love of self. You're not really searching for the truth, you're just trying to ensconce yourself at the top. But if you've never suffered, you'll never know that. You won't. You'll just keep believing the lie that you're the best, you're superior, your race is superior, and your nation is the only one that God has shed his grace on. And right across the border, God just doesn't care about those people. You can really live with those kind of ridiculous illusions. We're creating a high percentage of people that way, who are really capable of civil dialogue, of humane adult communication. I remember hearing the healthcare just human beings yelling at one another.
So, I guess first thoughts or comments on his. Anything jump out at you?
How about some
Oh, good. Good you got the message.
think our culture is a little different. We don't have our grandparents living with us like in the olden days, where the wisdom was around the house every day.
Yeah.
And the families kind of take care of when the baby's born and all that. You know, now we're assisted living and nursing homes, and our kids aren't around that. Just, I mean,
Earlier in the talk, he made the comment, it kind of struck me that, and I don't know if this is a fair statement or not, but he made the comment that, you know, United States is one of the few societies where we put our focus and we celebrate teenagers and you know, younger years, where most societies, especially Eastern societies, I think it's pretty safe to say, tend to celebrate older folks, folks with a little more wisdom and all that, and we put a lot of emphasis on youth and you know, looking younger, feeling younger, all that, and so I thought it was.
Seems like church could help fill that role, though, doesn't it? What you were talking about, yeah. Well, we ought to be a family where we are passing on.
You know, you're talking about celebrating youth here in the U.S. We're so much into sports that if you know. Let's say at 35, your career is over pretty much in most of the
yeah.
professional
yeah.
sports. Yeah. And so,
it's kind of crazy.
Well, you see all these sports professionals, as they get older, all they're doing is looking back at the career that they had when they were younger. And it's kind of interesting to look at that. You know, you saying that we celebrate youth in the U.S.,
yeah.
but it's kind of got to be that way anywhere that sports are a big phenomenon. It's that way
you're
up too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny. I don't know if you saw that stat. Don't know if it's true. You never know on these stats. But I saw something. 87% of professional football players are bankrupt within 5 years of, I mean, some crazy high number. And you're just like, it gets a little bit to this maturity. What is maturity really all about?
You have to be wise to
football. It'd be fast, yeah. Yeah. That's
right. I think there's less respect
for I'm sorry?
I think there's less and less respect for seasoned people and more mature people. I think they're just growing up. I was taught that when you walk into the room and there was someone older than you, you were supposed to speak first and speak to them. And when they back, you're supposed to say yes, ma'am, no, sir. And there was this reverence, and they listened to them all the time. Where that now it's like, well, we'll let the kids go first. Right? The kids, and so this respect for people that have been there and done that, I think it's lessened over the years.
I think that's true. Mm-hmm. The reason we thought of this as it relates to the subject of doubt, maybe it's obvious to you, but he talks a lot about, again, when you go from the container to the he calls it the content. You go from kind of the container to the where you're focusing more on the content. That I have especially questions, I would describe it this way, especially questions around doubt that are around, I would call it logic or reason, are probably the questions I care the least about anymore. I kind of can't even engage in a creationism versus evolution discussion. I to be maybe more blunt than I should be, I kind of don't care. And it's because I don't deal, that's not what I deal with. You know what I mean? That's not what I worry about as the content. I think of that as almost a container discussion a little bit, and I hope nobody's offended by that. But I, the types of doubts or questions or things like that is much more, for lack of a better word, emotional. Much more about is God near? Is God acting? Do I feel the presence of God? Do I feel like I'm in communion, those kind of things, are much more harder in some ways to deal with. But I can relate to those so much more than I can. To segue into talking about kids, one of the, you know, Paul had a bunch of doozies. But one of them was, it was frankly, it's, I hate to put it this way, it's almost a bit of a classic question. Paul came in to us, I don't know if you remember this, Paul came in to us and said, you know, if I was born in Bahrain, there's no way I'm a Christian. so what do you say? What I think we started learning to do a better job of, Jenny, much better than me, is, sometimes I, especially when Paul would get me, I won't get him in too much trouble, but especially since there are some police officers in the room, Paul came in one time and said, "I hate cops." And, we went into World War III on that one and all that stuff. And so...
And he didn't mean it.
He didn't mean it. Yeah. And what's so funny is that, if you know Paul, that is Paul. It is, "I want to argue with you." And I want to stir up the pot. And I want to, and it was about, equality. And I guess one thing that I'm proud of about Paul is most of the time the questions actually come from a pretty good place. They come from... fairness and equality, and are we treating people, in the right way? But sometimes it could be unnerving. And I think what we gained more and more comfort is just being able to say, "I don't know." And, the way Jane put it a second ago, God created the earth. I think he can probably handle your question. There's a quote later, by Rachel, if you look down, Rachel Held Evans on Evolving in Monkey Town. By the way, fabulous book if you've never read it. It's also about a woman growing up in a relatively conservative background and going through that experience of things that she had always known to been true. She started questioning, and wow, the real world's slapping me around the face, and do I still believe the things I always believed? And she's a very eloquent writer and makes it help. But if there's one thing I know for sure, it's that serious doubt, the kind that leads to despair, begins not when we start asking God questions, but when, out of fear, we stop. And I started appreciating that about my kids, that it's much scarier if they're not asking questions. And I would rather deal with not being able to answer the question than I would them not caring and being apathetic and not even in the game. And so... I started gaining a little comfort, and of course, and it's really easy, by the way, to say "I don't know," because those are hard questions, and you're going to get them. Those of you who have kids who maybe are younger, you're going to get them, and I took a lot of comfort in not always having to have the answer. One story, and especially since some of the people are in the room, about Paul. One of the trips, and I've made this comment to you, I've made this comment before. I always, Paul and I went to Nicaragua three times, I think, something like that. One of the first trips.
The first trip.
Was it? I went to bed, Paul stayed up with several of the people who are in this room. Sam, Christian, Ryan, Matt Noe was there, others. And they all got a taste of what my life was like on a day-to-day basis. But what was funny about that? Do what?
Paul woman.
Yeah. What was funny about that was the discussion about whether Paul won or not. What I appreciated was how little that mattered.
Yeah.
And what ended up mattering, is that the right? It ended up mattering is Paul got more engaged in church. And he wanted to come talk to Christian and Ryan and Sam because he now had a relationship and he had somebody that he could relate to. And
not because he agreed with everybody, but he had a relationship.
Let me go ahead and be for sure. He did not agree with everybody. but it meant a lot to us that here was an experience that you were going to Nicaragua and probably my favorite thing about that experience was that.
I was going to say, one of the stories Paul came back telling me, since I didn't go on the trip, he told me a story about Ryan. You could just tell he felt so much affection for you when he told the story, because he said they were having some great discussion, and you were sitting near, and you looked at me and you said, "Paul, you're building a house of cards." and he just laughed because he loved that. He knew you meant it affectionately, he respected that you didn't feel like you had to get in and correct him. You were going to let him figure it out. But it was a relationship. He told me a story about on the airplane, someone in their group laughed when the person in front of them lowered their seat down. Well, that seems minor, but for Paul, that was like, well, they're good-natured, even in things that are really irritating day in and day out. It was the relationships that he built out of that. So that ended up mattering more than whether he was right or wrong in a discussion, which I think is kind of the point of the kids part, is that you have to kind of, like, for us, it was having to let go of being right because we want to be in relationship. But I think that matters in church as well.
And I think, I think that's the thing I learned about that was just, again, I would encourage you as your kids get older in particular, you hear this from everybody. Of course, they stop listening to you as parents a little more. So make sure some of the other folks that they're interacting with are folks that, you know, you'd like to like them to be interacting with and get a different point of view. Jenny and I are funny. We got, I'm not much of a TV person, but we did a few years ago, got into West Wing. And so this is one of those clips that might mean more to me than it does to you. But the background here of this story is the boss is waiting for his employee. It's one of the staffers on the White House who his sister died when he was young, and he ended up with some issues over that that he was having trouble dealing with. So he went to talk to a psychiatrist, and this is him walking out of the psychiatrist's session. And his boss has waited for him to see kind of how it went. And to me, it's a comment about the kind of the importance of relationships.
How'd it go? Is you waiting around for me?
How'd it go?
He thinks I may have an eating disorder.
Josh.
And fear of rectangles. That's not what it is. I didn't get my hand on glass. I broke a window in my apartment.
This guy's walking down the street when he falls in the hall. The walls are so steep he can't get out. A doctor passes by and the guy shouts up, "Hey, you can yell me out." The doctor writes a prescription, throws it down in the hall and moves on. Then a priest comes along and the guy shouts up, "Father, I'm down in this hole, can you help me out?" Priest writes out a prayer, throws it down in the hall and moves on. Then a friend walks by. "Hey, Joe, it's me. Can you help me out?" And the friend jumps in the hole. Our guy says, "Are you stupid? Now we're both down here." The friend says, "Yeah, but I've been down here before and I know the way out." As long as I got a job, you got a job, you understand?
So I always like that story because sometimes I think I'll even be so bold as to say sometimes maybe we as a church are guilty of throwing the piece of paper in and especially when I hear people express doubt, I think we often... And this might be more true of males than females, by the way. I think we often want to solve it, right? I think we want to say, "Oh, well, let me send you the right article, give you the right book, tell you the right." And most of the time, what's your phrase about the brain and the reason? Reason is the...
Yeah, reason is the press secretary of the mind. You kind of know what you believe, and then you send reason out to make it look good.
And I would argue most of the time when people are dealing with these questions, and I think it's true with me, there's probably something underneath that, and a prescriptive quick answer is almost never what they're looking for, and something, whereas a relationship is almost always useful. And so I really related that story of, you know, if you kind of been there and done that, you're far more, even if you don't know the answer, you're kind of far more interesting and to be maybe more pointed. I think the gospel is far more about showing love to individuals necessarily than it is about having the right answer or being able to solve kind of hard questions that people are going through. And it is, to use Richard Rohr's word, it is freeing. It has some freedom to it. He had a great... tell me if I get the quote right. He quoted the Dalai Lama with a quote that was, you should really learn and study and understand the rules so you know exactly when to break them. And I really like that quote because I think there is some truth to part of wisdom is knowing what the rules are for in the first place, and maybe a greater appreciation for when you might need to break them. Which brings to the last conversation, which is, so what's the role of the church as it relates to doubt? I would call your attention to the second page, the back page of the stuff we handed out. Let me make this go away. Again, I mentioned this, Rachel Held Evans. She wrote a piece, I think it was in Time Magazine or something like that, and I would encourage you to actually go read the whole piece, but it's entitled Why Millennials Are Leaving the Church. If you've ever seen the stats, they're sobering. Church attendance for kids, whether with their families, is pretty good, and then it falls off a cliff. I mean, and typically church attendance for kids in their early 20s and in mid 20s goes down quite a bit. And so while she talks about it as millennials, I actually don't think this is a particularly new problem. I think this is something that's existed for a while. What I found interesting about her take, what I didn't include in the article, is she begins the article by saying, millennials are looking for authenticity and honesty. And she says, and whenever I talk about it, I undoubtedly have people say to me, well, so really they want coffee bars and hipper worship bands. And she laughs and she says, and then I hit my head against the desk because I think we sometimes, and I think I'm pretty proud of our church. I don't know if we've had such a draw to this as maybe others, but we get enamored with style issues. If you look at her first paragraph, time and time again, the assumption among Christian leaders is that the key to drawing 20-somethings back to church is simply to make a few style updates. Edgier music, more casual services, a coffee shop in the fellowship hall, a pastor who, I like that, a pastor who wears skinny jeans, an updated website. So, Scott, if you could start.
You don't think you want to see that.
But here's the thing, having been advertised to our whole lives, I'll skip the wording, but we're not easily impressed with consumerism or performances. In fact, I would argue that church is a performance is just one more thing that's driving us away from church, and evangelicalism in particular. We're increasingly drawn to high church traditions because it's not concerned about being cool, and we find that refreshingly authentic. What millennials really want from a church is not a change in style, but a change in substance. We want an end to the culture wars. We want a truce between science and faith. We want to be known for what we stand for, not what we are against. We want to ask questions that don't have predetermined answers. We want churches that emphasize an allegiance to the kingdom of God over allegiance to a single political party or a single nation. We want our LGBT friends to feel truly welcome in our faith communities. We want to be challenged to live lives of holiness, not only when it comes to sex, but also when it comes to simply living, caring for poor and oppressed, pursuing reconciliation, engaging in creation care, and becoming peacemakers. So I guess a couple of thoughts. One, what are your thoughts on that? And maybe more broadly, what do you think we could do as a church that makes us more open first, you got to buy the premise, I guess, that we should be more open to doubt and questioning. But in particular, when we have those amongst us who are struggling, how do we make it more friendly, for lack of a word, better word? How do we make it more friendly to folks so that they can be comfortable talking about those things? And
would you be comfortable if people talked about those things?
I think one of the most important things that we have to get to, and we do an okay job of this, but can always do better, is that we have to have a mutual understanding that we all don't have to agree on every single issue, and that's okay. So that there is unity in diversity. And that we all come with different worldviews and different answers to different problems is one thing that actually can unite us. And so, but there has to be like a general understanding of that, right? And that there's some higher truths that we hold on to, but that it's that not only is it that we're going to disagree, but that it's okay that we disagree. And that, I think, is something that is kind of hard to hold on to, that we can have very different ideas about even things that we think are pretty serious within the church. And really, that doesn't matter, because forming a true bonding community is what matters, and not some of these ancillary issues that tend to drive us apart. But I think it's more of the acceptance of, we will never agree on this, and that is okay. And not kind of judging someone in a particular way based on, right, one way or the other. So
I disagree with that. I thought it was kind of interesting. We were having a discussion last night where, in kind of bringing the Bible in comparison to what people say, like the Constitution, right? That the Constitution needs to change over time based on, you know, different beliefs, different people coming in, different immigration, all that. It has a built-in mechanism to make that change, right? The forefathers put that in there. When people say that same thing about the Bible, that, oh, it needs to change, the message needs to change because the population is different, I'm not sure that it's got a built-in method to change really what the substance or the will of God is, just based on our political changes in the world.
Yeah, and I think, for me, I look at it quite simply. We have to do what we're already called to do, which is depart from the world, right? The world, I saw a great quote this weekend. It said, two taglines, society, be who you want to be. Society, no, not that one, right? and to Sam's point, we have this unilateral approach in society and world where everything is black and white, or, you know, just because you're part of this group or that group, you're already wrong. And I like the approach that we're all going to have different views, and we have to embrace that, right?
You know, one thing that has really hit me so much is I'm so different today than I was 10 years ago. You know, and 10 years from now, I bet I'm different again. And I'd like to still be a part of this church and still have had a long-term relationship and had people love me throughout my journey. Because I can look back on things I was just wrong on before. And I may look back now, 10 years from now, and think, oh, yeah, I was wrong. I mean, I think that's why Ryan, it was easy for him to say to Paul, you're building a house of cards, but think, okay, he'll find it out. You kind of get he's a kid, and he'll figure it out. But we're all kind of on the journey like that, right? That it's just, yeah, we just want to be together.
Yeah. I appreciate this. I mean, this class is rather timely. I realize that I'm about to embark on a journey with Nicholas, because over the last 2 or 3 weeks, boy, reading him stories, I can see the wheels turning. And it's refreshing to know that I don't have to have the answers, right? The relationship that I have with Nicholas is more valuable, and the fact that he's asking those questions and feels comfortable asking those questions, I need to keep that ahead of me.
Don't you just think that teaches you how you ought to treat people outside your family too?
Exactly.
Like, I'm so all in with my kids. I want to feel that way for other people. Because, yeah, there's nothing they're going to do that's going to make me want to shut down on them. Yeah.
I think for me, everything goes back to what he said in that video was wisdom. Because I've always looked at wisdom early in life. When I looked to someone who had wisdom, oh, he's going to give me the answer and tell me what to do.
Yeah.
The older I'm getting, I don't want the answer. I want to figure it out, but I want all the options out there. And like what Sam was saying, we've had conversations before. There are things that I used to look at, and people would say certain things to me, and I wouldn't be anywhere around me. Whereas now, I kind of like different, and I may still, I'm still believing the way I believe, but I'm not going to alienate you because you feel that way. Mm. And I never would have done that before. It's just over these last couple of years that I've really started to do that. But that wisdom quote for me, and or, whereas before, I just wisdom with someone who, he's going to give me the answer.
I think spending time with older people, yes, you see that. I mean, no matter what their faith yeah. is or their belief, just hearing experiences they
that's
go
right.
through
yeah.
just adds to that. Because there's a lot of dead young white men.
No, that's right. Yeah. And we were going to talk, but celebrating, there's a good quote, and we won't read it now, but somewhere in there, when the, it's actually the guy who wrote You Lost Me, which is a book about losing our youth. He talks about celebrating that exact fact, that the church is one of the rare institutions where people from almost every both age, but also socioeconomic, and there's an interesting mix of people that get exposed to each other. And there aren't too many, if you think about it, there aren't too many other settings where you have that. And we ought to celebrate that and take advantage of the fact that we've got, you know, all age groups and different things. So. Well, thank you very much for your comments.
That's the bells and whistles. I think our church does that. Because if we all agreed, then half these people would be here. I mean, we love people. We agree with everybody, but we love them. And Paul didn't run away from our church after that conversation. He engaged.
Yeah.
He knows the guy that did it. So.
Yeah, that mattered more than whether they agreed.
That's right. Is we do love each other and we're convinced in heart.
Yeah.
Yeah, the worst thing that could have happened out of that conversation is a bunch of people being real dogmatic about. Then Paul would have gotten turned off. No, thank you very much. I appreciate it.